Like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting together. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, 2024. Please silence all cell phones. The time is 9:10 a.m. We're joined by Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, Senator Bishop, Senator Stedman, co-chair Stedman, and co-chair Hoffman. Like to acknowledge that we have Senator Diesel here in the in the gallery. We're going to hear one bill today. That's this SB 217, the rail belt transmission system by the governor. We heard the background presentation over the last several days on this issue, specifically Tuesday and Wednesday. This is the initial hearing on the bill itself. Introducing the bill is going to be Andrew Jensen, the policy advisor for Governor Dunleavy. He's in person and has a presentation. After that, we'll go to the invited testimony. Mr. Jensen, identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, Andrew Jensen, Governor Dunleavy's energy policy advisor and also the areas of food security. So I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 217, which is the governor's legislation dealing with the rail belt transmission system. And, you know, this policy is designed to, you know, incentivize energy development and allow for the movement of the lowest cost power throughout the system, regardless of the way it's generated, regardless of where it's generated. So with that, I can go ahead and move through here. So just for the quick overview of the area that is served by the rail belt, this is the area from the Kenai Peninsula all the way up into Fairbanks and over to Delta Junction. It is about 700 miles long and serves about 75 to 80% of the state's population. It is largely collected by a single transmission line. And these assets, transmission assets, are owned by the Rail Belt Utilities and the Alaska Energy Authority. And so much of the Rail Belt has few alternative pathways. So you have single lines. This can lead to congestion. It can lead to capacity constraints, line loss. And of course, you have a vulnerability with, you know, single points of failure that can impact the entire system.
Mr. Jensen, if I could just advise you, go ahead and take your time so we can have time to digest this big concept that's going. It's like a big boulder coming down at us. And we want to make sure we can.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. So the system that we have is, because we have these multiple owners within the system, there is some inefficiencies in the way the system is connected, but it's not really fully integrated because of the diverse ownership of the assets. And so we have these things that are known as a wheeling charge. And so the wheeling charge applies when power transits a utility owner's system that what was not generated by them. So if power moves from Chugach to Golden Valley, it would have a fee assessed at the through the Matanuska electric system. There's a fee passing over the Alaska Intertie before it reaches Golden Valley. So that's what we refer to as wheeling rates. And it's not a perfect analogy, but it's somewhat more like a toll road than a public highway. So you're kind of paying each step of the way as the power moves across the system. And so these costs, they are passed down to the ratepayer. But when they're assessed in the wholesale part of the transaction, that in some cases can prevent the lowest cost power from being sold or transmitted. So that's what we're trying to address with this legislation. So these charges, they can unnecessarily hinder the economic dispatch of power. And on another level, which is another thing the bill tries to address, is that they can reduce the ability of independent power producers to enter into power purchase agreements with local utilities if the wheeling tariff is something that's going to be included within that cost of power. So they have to account for that. And those things can vary. I think there's, when you have a rate case, for example, Chugach is in a rate case right now where these tariffs would change. And so if you're trying to sell a long-term contract, but then the wheeling rate changes in the middle of your contract, then that may impact your cost of power sold. So these things, the way that they're currently transmission costs are recovered in some cases can be a barrier to project development or lowest cost power being sold among utilities or from an independent power producer. So what Senate...
Mr. Jensen.
Sorry.
Who sets the wheeling rate?
The wheeling rate, Mr. Chairman, the wheeling rate is proposed by each individual utility and then ultimately has to be approved by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
So the RCA is the final...
Yes. So they have to evaluate everything for, just and reasonable, economic value, and et cetera. So they have a number of criteria they look at. So the utility proposes it, and then ultimately the RCA has to approve it.
The only other thing I was going to say is that when you change slides, it wouldn't stop. Tell us you're going to change slides. We'll ask you if there are any further questions by members of the committee.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. So, again, this was just another map of the system that shows the diversity of ownership among the systems. So you see in some places there's a couple lines, but largely there's that single line. And, sort of down there on the Kenai Peninsula where you see the what's known as the SSQ section, the Sterling Quartz Creek area, that is an AEA-owned asset. And when we talk about things like a single point of failure, that was the example of that would be the Swan Lake fire several years ago. It took that line was offline for several months. And so that isolated the rest of the rail belt system from Bradley Lake. Mm-hmm. And so that I think the estimates have been it was maybe an additional $12 million in cost to ratepayers from having to use the more expensive gas generated or coal or fuel oil generated power. So that's one thing, and that line is being upgraded right now. It's funded, it's underway right now, and so that's going to be a big benefit to the system in addition to the GRIP project, which is going to go obviously the other way, but they'll both be 230 kilovolts, and the line currently is 115. So that will help deconstrain the system. More Bradley Lake power will move, so that's actually a very important project to allow more free-flowing power throughout the system.
And Mr. Jensen, is that federally funded completely?
That is being funded, Mr. Chairman, through revenue bonds that AEA sold in 2022. Under the terms of the Bradley Lake Power Agreement, the utilities helped finance that. And so that those bonds were retired, I believe, in 2021. And so but the utilities still owe what are known as excess payments. It's about $12.5 million per year from each of the collectively among the utilities. So they essentially borrowed as much as they could for as long as that those payments are owed. And I think it's till about 2048. And so they got about $166 million. And so $90 million of that is being used to do that upgrade on the SSQ line. And so that's being done without any impact on ratepayers because those payments to AEA are already accounted for in the rate. So that was actually a very positive thing that they were able to finance that project without having to raise rates.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then I'll just move on to the next slide regarding the section of the legislation introduced by the governor that addresses independent power producers. So the Senate Bill 217, as it was introduced and as is in the committee substitute that's before you, adds a new section to the statute regarding the taxation of independent power producers that would equalize their tax treatment compared to nonprofit electric cooperatives and municipally owned utilities. So currently, under state policy, state statute, those member-owned or municipally owned cooperatives do not pay any local property or sales taxes or state corporate taxes. And so what this would do is if you are an independent power producer that is only selling power, wholesale power directly to a utility, you would have that same exemption from local property taxes and any state corporate income taxes. Taxes are a large portion, of course, of any large project, and it impacts cost competitiveness. It impacts the timing of projects. If you have to go through a lot of local, perhaps negotiations to get some kind of a tax exemption under local ordinance. And so that was why we looked at this and we wanted to make it very narrow to you only get this exemption if you're only selling to a tax exempt entity. Because, you know, certainly, you know, if Shugach built a 100 megawatt wind farm, that asset would be tax exempt. But if they, you know, for financial reasons want to partner with somebody, but then that entity becomes taxed, then that may be the barrier to getting a project done. So that's why we wanted to make sure it's only that wholesale relationship between the utilities. And we believe this will also allow for more projects at scale, because then you can build a larger project. And if you can sell that power up and down the system, because what we see now on the rail belt is the renewable, and I shouldn't say renewable, because this is not limited just to renewable. It could be a small modular nuclear, it could be a coal plant, it could be any source of power generation, it could be. But what we've seen is that these renewable projects, like you see on the slide, the solar farm, and I think that's the one in Willow, and then the one, the Fire Island wind farm, they only sell to the local utility, because when you add on the wheeling rate, maybe to move up and down the system, then the costs may become uneconomic. I think Fire Island has provided written comment on this, that they wanted to expand the project and sell to Golden Valley. But once, you know, it crossed Chugach's system, MEA system, you know, the intertie, then it wasn't cost competitive at that point. And so
Senator Keel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Jensen, these new power producers would be for-profit or non-profit?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, sorry, they are a for-profit entity. And so, you know, any federal, you know, taxes or anything like that, they may pay. And, you know, and if they wanted to sell to an industrial customer just directly, that tax exemption would go away. So they are for-profit entities, but the bill in the committee substitute that you'll hear more about later does require that the tax exemption be reflected in the contract that they sign with the utility. So we have it constructed so that it ensures that tax exemption flows through to the ratepayer. So yes, they are for-profit, but
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, you can reflect the tax exemption in the contract, but money is fungible. So I guess the question would, first question and follow up would be who regulates that contract to ensure that the tax exemption is passed through?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Keel, the RCA. All of these power purchase agreements have to be reviewed and approved by the RCA. So that would ensure that the tax exemption is reflected in the cost of power. And the public testimony we've heard from the project developers, like Alaska Renewables, for example, said they already do this math where they can do side-by-side comparisons. Here's the cost with property taxes. Here is it without property taxes. And they said they were willing to certainly provide that. The RCA can require it. And Commissioner Doyle, in some public, in some testimony in response to questions along these lines, said that they'll, you know, often bring in the Department of Revenue to help look at the numbers to make sure that they that if there is some benefit or something that's in there, that it is reflected in the rate.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Jensen, the economics you talk about, the impact of property taxes and the effect of low power rates on local economies and the benefits also apply in places where there are regulated utilities that are not nonprofits. If the desire underlying this provision is to incentivize the most economic, low-cost energy production, why would we exclude some Alaskans who happen to be served by an investor-owned utility? The Alaskan doesn't choose the utility structure.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, I appreciate that question, and it is something that we had to think about. And our concern was to do anything that would create an unequal playing field. So if you had an investor-owned utility that is subject to local taxes, state corporate taxes, local sales taxes, and then you have another project that doesn't pay any of those, you would create an unequal playing field in those circumstances. So we looked at it as if the co-op doesn't pay tax, then the person selling straight to them won't pay the tax. But if both of them are paying taxes, then it's an equal field in terms of the cost of power. So I think that if any of those concerns would have to be where make sure that it's an equal playing field.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up comment. If we're exempting some for-profits from tax and not other for-profits from tax, we're creating an unequal playing field by doing so.
It certainly appears to be that, Mr. Jensen. Maybe you can clear it up a little later, but it sounds like there is some push and pull here that I'm not fully appreciating.
Certainly. No, Mr. Chairman and Senator Keel, no, I do appreciate that comment. And, you know, our desire was to smooth the way and incentivize development, because on the rail belt, we know that there's a gas situation that we're all very well aware of. The utilities are, you know, all looking for alternative sources of electric power generation. And so in the environment that we're in, there's always sort of a trade-off in policy. And so if the property taxes or the wheeling charges are the barriers that are keeping projects and new energy from being developed, then we felt like we needed to address those facts to allow project development to go forward. And so, you know, there's the only way there's foregone revenue is if a project is built. We don't want to take away the current revenue. And so the benefits of the project getting built where there is an energy problem, we believe outweigh, you know, I mean, I think the concerns that you may have on that.
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jensen, in Bethel used to be owned by a profit entity, and the way that was resolved was that the Bethel Utilities was set up as a nonprofit to get the non-tax status, which resulted in about a 20% reduction in utility rates for the people of Bethel. The question that I have, you know, and that's something that I wanted to put on the table, but can you give me an example of other profit entities in the state of Alaska that would currently have this non-tax status?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I would have to look into that and get back to you. I mean, I know that there's a variety of tax policies in, you know, that are, whether they're incentives or credits or et cetera. I mean, I think that over many industries and many many subjects, there's a variety of tax incentives for that apply to for-profit entities, but happy to get back to you.
Just a comment to address Senator Keel's comment. The way that Bethel did it was a simpler way to do it, which resulted in lower rates for the people of Bethel. You know, where they didn't have to, as a nonprofit, you don't have to pay out dividends that were eliminated, federal taxes, a lot of other benefits that the people of Bethel ended up realizing, and that seemed to be a simpler way to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jensen, are you familiar with what he was talking about that happened a number of decades ago with the for-profit entity?
No, I'm not familiar with that, but I'll be happy to speak more with you.
Are there any other entities within the state of Alaska that are following that same model that are maybe still in business?
I'm not familiar. No, I'm not familiar. So, you know, certainly rather than get out of my lane, I'd be happy to look into it and follow up with the committee.
If you would, please go ahead and put your presentation.
Thank you. So moving on to where we're looking at, what is the current version in front of you? What does it now do? So I covered the original components of the bill, which was eliminating the wheeling rates by requiring the rail belt utilities to create a new cost recovery mechanism. So that was in the original version. It extends the tax relief provision enjoyed by cooperatives and municipal utilities to independent power producers. That was in the original and is still in the version before you. And then what follows is what's new. And I think that's what you're going to hear more about in this hearing. So happy to just kind of walk through those fairly quickly here. It establishes a rail belt transmission organization within the Alaska Energy Authority. This is the organization that would be responsible not only for coming up with the cost recovery tariff, but a number of other things, including managing the assets, integrated transmission planning, et cetera. It creates a net metering incentive for 7 years after the effective date of the act. It increases revenue to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and to the Department of Law's Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section. The RCA is not funded by general funds. It receives only these regulatory cost charges. And so the RCA, you know, the workload is high, and we definitely feel like that additional staff and additional resources for the RCA would definitely be beneficial. And this was actually a governor's bill that was introduced to achieve this, that has been folded into 217. It then also exempts energy projects of less than 15 megawatts from RCA pre-approval. This would allow utilities through their boards of directors to go ahead and develop projects of, you know, fairly small size without having to go through a fairly lengthy and expensive regulatory process. It increases salaries for RCA commissioners. And I guess this is tied into what the second bill, and I probably should have done them in a different order there. But the bill changes the qualifications for RCA commissioners, and then and provides for a transition between the current members and when those vacancies may occur. And so then, because we're increasing those, or the bill increases those qualifications, it then also increases the step salary for those commissioners. Certainly, if you're looking to hire more experienced, highly qualified people from the private sector, you know that you have to be competitive on salary. So that's what that provision does. It also creates a AEA board, separating it from the current structure, which is where AEA and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, they share a board. And so this would create a new board strictly for AEA. And then finally, and I guess I addressed this a little bit up top, is that it moves transmission planning, integrated transmission planning, from the Electric Reliability Organization. This was something that was created under statute, Senate Bill 123 in 2020. So it's known as an ERO. There's only one of these in the state. It's on the rail belt. It's called the Rail Belt Reliability Council, or the RRC. So there's probably going to be a few acronyms that come your way. So just to familiarize yourself with those. And it moves transmission planning from that entity to this new Rail Belt Transmission Organization for the purposes of you know, the management and other functions. And with that, happy to take any additional questions.
One question I do have, Mr. Jensen, has to do with your net metering. Mm-hmm. It has a restriction of 7 years after the effective date. How was that derived at for 7 years?
Well, that was an amendment that was introduced by Senator Klayman in the process in Senate Resources. Mm-hmm. So, and so I don't necessarily want to speak to exactly the reasons on that. I think there's something around where federal incentives may expire, and so it may be aligned with that. But there's also an issue with, you know, the cost of that and et cetera. And so to put some sort of a limit or a sunset on
the administration is in favor of it.
Well, the governor is in favor of incentivizing, residential, you know, renewable systems. And so he's absolutely in favor of that. So I think that there's, you know, and you'll hear different comments, I think, about the best way to do that. I think, you know, Senator Wilkowski had a bill that successfully passed around community solar that had some language around how you deal with, you know, how you reimburse for power that returns to the grid.
Senator Wilson has a question.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Also on the same topic of the net metering. So after the 7 years, what would happen after that credit were expired? There's no more. Do we go back to sort of a net billing, or how does that apply? Or would I just disconnect my power from that utility, and the utility no longer is able to access the additional power that these homeowners or co-ops may decide to have?
Senator, through the chair, Senator Wilson, there is a current regulation around how power is reimbursed to the customer. And so I think it might be better for, you know, Senator Klayman, or maybe perhaps Senate resource staff to get more into the details of exactly what it would revert to. But the current system is, if you offset your power. So, for example, if you receive 700 kilowatts of power in a month and you generate 300, then you do get a full retail credit for that difference. So say if you're offsetting your use, you get full retail. If you have 400 kilowatts delivered, but you generate 700, so you have 300 kilowatts above, you receive what's called the avoided cost. And so what that refers to is what it would cost the utility to burn fuel to generate the power on their own, which, so for Matanuska, I think it's around 7.5 cents per kilowatt compared to the full retail rate, which is closer to 20.
Bob, Senator Wilson?
No, I guess we'll try to get that for their information.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jensen, on the exemption from pre-approval, can you make me a little smarter about that? Where in the state does that apply? Is that only limited to folks in the RTO? And how did we come up with that 15 megawatt number?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Keel, that was actually something I believe that Chugach Electric went and worked with Zach Fields, Representative Fields, in the House, because they just worked on a community solar project that was around 0.5 megawatt, and they had to go through a full, you know, regulatory process for approval on that. And I don't want to, you know, overstep, but I think that 15 megawatt threshold is found somewhere else in regulation. But I can get back to you on that, exactly where that 15 megawatts was picked, and certainly there's Representative Fields may be a good resource on that. We can follow up with you on where that landed, but I can tell you that was supported and brought forward by Chugach just based on their recent experience, and then also looking at, you know, the RCA has got a big workload, and so if you can, you know, projects that are fairly small that the utility board of directors has elected to pursue, that was the genesis of that.
Bob, Senator Keel.
But thanks, Mr. Chairman. Would be interested in that follow-up. It's doing it based on the faceplate capacity has a differential effect based on what your energy source is. Some things are cheap to install and expensive to run. Other things cost a fortune to install, but hydro dams don't have any fuel cost. So 15 megawatts of gas, you know, is very cheap, but you got to keep paying for the gas, and there's a rate impact to that. 15 megawatts of Lake Tap Hydro, that can cost you $150 million before you blink. That has a very different rate impact. So I'd be interested in thinking through what potential impact to the ratepayer we're exempting and where.
Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Keel, and I appreciate that. And I think that where your safeguard would be is these would be projects that the utilities board of directors, who are elected by the members, have decided to go forward with. So their responsibility, fiduciary, is to their members and to keep their costs, you know, as low as possible. And so there is that check, because it wouldn't be where one utility builds something that raises rates on another, you know, another set of customers. This would be something where the board of directors, elected by the owners, or the member owners, would be making that decision. So you would expect for them to have certainly the best interests of their members at heart. So that is one factor to consider in terms of where, if you're going to look at a smaller project that they may want to go forward with.
Just in, Paul, so this applies only to co-ops?
Well, you know, we'll get back to you on that one. Yes, through the chair. Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think that's good to decide on. Yes.
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jensen, could you provide my office with the how much of the workload in recent history has the RCA spent on projects of 15 megawatts or less? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you able to get us that information?
Yes, I will definitely. Yes, through the chair, Senator Hoffman.
When can we expect?
As soon as I get out of this morning, I'll make some emails and some phone calls and see where that information may lie.
By tomorrow morning.
I will absolutely go for that. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thank you for being here, Mr. Jensen. Can you tell us a little more about the history of the Swan Lake fire? Who owned the lines before the fire? Who owns them now? I believe you said $12 million was the cost to those that were cut off from Bradley Lake. Can you speak to what happened to the rates for those that were still on power from Bradley Lake?
Mr. Jensen.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, certainly at the time they were owned by Homer Electric. The SSQ line was owned by Homer. And so the obviously it was very expensive looking at what it was going to take to repair that. It took quite a long time. And I think that there was, you know, certainly as the longer it went without getting repaired, the more that the utilities, you know, that were cut off were interested in finding a solution. And I think they actually had to spill some water at Bradley because they didn't have anywhere to sell it. And so in the aftermath of that, AEA went ahead and bought the SSQ from Homer for I think about $17 million. And they did a revenue bond with Ada for that. And then one of the first excess payments that they received from the utilities after the bonds retired, they put that $12.5 million toward that SSQ purchase. And so so Homer owned it then. As a result of that, AEA owns it now, and that's why that project is now going forward with getting improved.
And we'll go on indefinitely that AEA will own that line? Yes. That AEA will own that line?
Yes, I believe so, sir.
Mr. Mayor, follow up?
Yes, thank you. And how did rates, how were rates impacted? Homer Electric.
Yes. Thank you for that follow-up through the chair, Senator Merrick. They definitely went up. And $12 million over that number of customers, I'm not sure what that would translate to on a per kilowatt basis. But because utilities they recover their fuel costs. They don't have to go to the RCA every time their fuel costs are necessarily go up. They just simply have to generate more power from gas or from a different source. And so the rates just naturally increase based on their fuel cost.
I'm sorry. I was referring to those that still had connection to Bradley Lake.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chairman. I believe they would have remained the same, but I can certainly follow up on that because they were still getting power from their, you know, Homer has generation capacity and access to Bradley Lake power. So, but I can try to get a clarification on that.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Oh, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One, in this piece of legislation, if a utility gets islanded due to maintenance or ongoing upgrades, do you feel that they're rightly compensated because of the sort of the one-way power utilization?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I believe that when the utilities go through the process to create this new transmission mechanism, then that what happens in those situations would absolutely be addressed within the tariff. So you wouldn't have to, if you're not able to access the system, then, you know, your responsibility for paying for the system would not be there. So I think that there's through that process, they'll be able to account for that.
And with that, I mean, there's going to be clearly winners and losers, you know, in the system when we first start this going up. Some are going to benefit at a faster, greater rate, and others are just going to sort of suffer through until a time period where their costs will sort of balance out to the lower pay raters. Is there something that can be done in this piece of legislation to ensure that we don't have as great of a losers in terms of some of these power these utility companies?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, in the initial probably phase of it, there's going to be a little bit of reallocation of costs. But I think it's important to remember or think about, you know, how these costs compare to the overall revenue requirement for the utilities. So the overall system of transmission is around $70 million compared to the overall revenue requirement of about $905 million. So the transmission system costs are around 7.5-ish% of the total rate that they see. And then if you drill down even further on that, if you have like a 0.5% move here or there, it's going to be pretty minimal, we believe, at least in the opening. But also that is part of what the utilities are going to have to do amongst themselves to come up with something amongst themselves. And then also the RCA has to review it. The RCA has to approve to make sure it's fair to the ratepayers and that those concerns are addressed. And you know, the utilities have told us that, you know, going back to November, each member of the Rail Belt utility asset owners, along with, I believe, a regulatory attorney and a consultant from the lower 48 that they've hired, they've been meeting weekly to try to figure out what this transmission cost recovery mechanism would look like. And John Burns, the CEO of Golden Valley, in his testimony last week to House Finance, said that he expects that by the end of this year, they would have, you know, something agreed upon that they could, you know, potentially bring forward to the RCA. So I think in the interim, in the initial step, you can see a little bit of shuffling among the way the transmission costs are recovered, because there's only, I think I've seen maybe 5 to 10% of the power that moves is subject to these wheeling tariffs. So then you look at that revenue and how it might be tweaked potentially. But in the long run, this we believe will benefit all ratepayers because you'll be able to have projects of larger scale that can sell power throughout the system. And so in the end, we're looking at the alternative of imported LNG, the cost of that, or other potential issues. So we believe in the long run, this can stabilize and lead to lower costs because even the independent power producers, they have to come in at a competitive cost of what the utilities are paying now.
And absolutely. Yeah, I understand that, but you're stating that it's up to utilities to decide that, but we're about to pass a piece of legislation that's going to mandate them sort of loss or sort of revenue for them. So how are we balancing this out, saying that we're doing thou shalt, but it's up to you six to determine the rates?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilson. We actually, the intent is not to take, you know, revenue because the $70 million that it costs to run the system would still be $70 million that's recovered. So the intent is not to take from that overall system, but it's the way that it is currently those costs are recovered. And they're being captured within the wholesale transactions versus perhaps at the end point on a per kilowatt hour basis, you know, like other charges you may see on your bill. So no, the intent is not to, and because the utilities have to negotiate with, amongst themselves, and they have to bring something that can pass muster with the RCA, we believe there's a number of public safeguards that are in place to certainly minimize the initial impact. And I think I've seen some numbers and I think Golden Valley and MEA have looked at some of these, what it might look like numbers wise, and they can see maybe a little bit of reallocation towards their ratepayers, but they do see the long-term, what this could do to smooth out the transfer of power throughout the rail belt.
Thank you. Senator Wilson. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Senator Wilson's sort of line of questioning, I think we all understand that there's long-term benefit in getting here. And the question about fairness in the short term and where we get is always contentious. The fallback, the referee, has long been the Regulatory Commission, the RCA. They're slow, but it's good to have a referee, right? They have certain principles: just, equitable, cost causer, cost payer. Are there elements, as this bill comes to us today out of the Resources Committee, are there elements here that the RCA doesn't get to look at? Are there elements here that are decided only by the new organization without that review?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the transmission cost recovery tariff is the main thing that's under the RCA's purview in this case. It's, I guess, what they would call it is economic regulation. So that encompasses, so anything they bring forward to justify their costs, whether that's a project or maintenance or their debt service or however they're allocating their costs, RCA has to look at that and determine if it is, it fits those criteria of just and reasonable. So the economic regulation of the transmission costs through this mechanism does actually give them a wide sort of way to have oversight over the cost, because ultimately the cost goes to the ratepayer, whether it's being recovered through a wheeling rate, through a wholesale charge, or whatever. The ratepayer is ultimately paying these transmission costs today. So what we're looking at is just a more efficient way to collect that revenue to where it doesn't interrupt sales between utilities or sales between an IPP and a utility that may have to cross another system. So yes, the RCA is the ultimate arbiter on this. And through that regulation of the tariff, they will have broad sort of insight into the costs and why the costs are what they are.
Thank you.
Bob, Senator Keel. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. I have a question here on Section 18 under Rail Belt Transmission Organization on page 12, when it starts to talk upon sort of new work and maintenance that it's going to be performed by the organization. And just wondering, here were the last sentence in on page 12, line 7, on that section D. The work performed must be subject to the terms and condition of any existing collective bargaining agreements. Is this an item that it's at the individual where the location happens in the rail belt? So is it MEA? Is it Chugiak? Is it Homer? Collecting bargaining agreements that they're collecting? Is it the collecting bargaining agreements of the workers, the contractors being performed? And if it's a geographical situation, does that collective bargaining agreement change if it's in the midline? Let's say they're doing work in between Golden Valley and MEA's line. Can you explain that to me?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I would like to defer to Senate Resource staff on that, because that was something that came in within their process, and it wasn't something that the governor had in his original version of the bill.
So, no interpretation how that would work, because it won't be sort of Senate Resources or the state or us to enforce or to regulate that in terms of interpretation. I'm just wondering how that would work. I'm just, sooner or later we just need one person to tell us and really understand the bill. And I get a lot of, we got to go ask someone else. You got to go ask someone else. Every time I go ask somebody, it's go ask someone else. And so I'm just getting a little frustrated, Mr. Chairman, upon that.
It certainly is. But Mr. Jensen, I realize that it wasn't necessarily coming from your office or the administration's office. So we can ask the appropriate person when they do come refer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Wilson, I do understand your concern there. Absolutely. I just know that this was, there was concern out there that, that some of this federal money that's coming in, you know, that it may be, you know, out of state workers or whatever. And so, I mean, I think you can see where there's an intent there to protect existing union relationships or union contracts in with the utilities. So, but I think Senate Resources was more involved in the development of that. So I would defer to them on that.
Thank you.
We have Senator Giesel coming up here next. She's the chairman of Resources. Sure. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe there's some confusion over who's on first and who's on second, I guess, presenting the bill and what's supported in the bill. So could you give us an idea what the administration support is of the different changes in the bill, and the bill in itself?
Mr. Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stebbin, the governor has some overarching policy goals for this legislation. He wants the open access, non-discriminatory to the source of generation, so that power can move from anywhere to anywhere. And he wants the lowest cost power to be able to move without any, you know, economic or say maybe an artificial barrier. Those are his overarching objectives for the legislation that we addressed through the what was originally in there. The governor wants to see something come to him that has broad support. And this is now in the hands of the legislature, and you know, the other aspects of the bill that are in it now, I think you're going to hear a variety of comments on some of those differing comments on what's in there. And so what the governor really wants is to see something come to him that has broad support, as broad a support as possible, that achieves his policy objectives. And so there's things in the bill that we introduced in 217. There was things that we introduced through House Bill 313. And I'm sorry, I don't know the Senate companion number for the revenue increase for the RCA. So there's definitely things that the governor's office introduced, and we certainly do support. And then beyond that, things that we didn't put in initially that are there now. The legislature will have to take all the public input that you're going to receive. But ultimately, he wants something that will have broad support across the legislature that achieves his goals.
Bob, Senator Stedman.
Well, it would be nice at some point we get a little more definitive answer. Broad is a pretty broad term. So
I guess I could say through the chair, Senator Stedman, there are, I believe, there's wide alignment on eliminating wheeling rates and for the tax exemption provision. I think that those are very, I've not heard any objection on the tax exemption provision to date from both the local governments along the rail belt that this may impact. So those things have wide alignment. So looking at things where there might not be alignment that might hurt the chances of the bill passing, that's where, you know, that will be where the legislature has to have the input.
Bob Simpson.
Well, at the end of the day, the governor has to sign this, or we're just all wasting our time here at the end of session. So we need some more definitive answers out of the administration as we work through the final steps of this piece of legislation. Because we want a successful legislative process here in the next week and a half. Not find out that what we thought was a good idea, there was, you know, indigestion for, and so we have to start over in January, because frankly, there's a concern that there's a high interest that we move to the next step next winter so we can start working on the financial package to build this intertie out.
You understand where we're coming from, Mr. Johnson?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Simmons, I certainly do. I guess to that point, I would say there's nothing in this bill as it stands now that we would consider a red line or a no-go or anything along those lines. But it's just difficult to, you know, to speak to things that we didn't put forward on our own. And so so I would say that at this point, there is nothing in the bill that would, you know, that would we would consider a red line, I guess I could say.
Senator Wilson.
So is that the same as saying that you support everything in this current piece of legislation as is, gets sort of the green light?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. That? Yeah, I really can speak to the things the governor introduced that the governor supports. And so beyond that, there's a lot of competing, voices that you're going to hear from. And so we want to see the process play out so that it does, that it gets to him with a high level of support.
Senator Hoffman.
Just a broad statement. I don't know anyone or any industry that would object to being tax exempt.
No comment, Mr. Jensen?
Well, no comment. Okay. That was a comment. I'm happy to answer a question if that was that.
Any further questions, Mr. Jensen, by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon. Thanks for slowing down, by the way.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. This isn't a lot of experience that I have doing this, so I appreciate your patience and the indulgence of the committee. Thank you.
Next we have up is invited testimony, Senator Kathy Diesel, co-chair of the Senate Resources Committee, who produced the current committee substitute. Please come up, identify yourself, and go ahead with your explanation of the committee substitute that we have in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District E. That's part of the municipality of Anchorage, going all the way down to Whittier. Mr. Chairman, if you would authorize your permission, I would like to have my staff, Angela Rodell, join me.
Ms. Rodell, please come on up. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead and be available for the co-chair of resources.
Mr. Chairman, before Ms. Rodell begins, she has provided a PowerPoint here, but I want to lay a foundation. This bill has been intensely worked on for about 8 months. The genesis of the bill was a trip that a number of us took from the Senate and the House, including the utilities, to Iceland, where we reviewed what a similar-sized entity had done to lower their costs for renewable energies and create a robust economy, an economy where, first of all, they were isolated from other areas. We also are isolated. They have families living there that had high utility bills. They had massive pollution problems from burning diesel to generate power. They had young people leaving the country. And as they integrated their power system and created a ring around the island, they allowed independent power production to happen. Farms would create hydro projects on their property and feed power not only to that area, that farm and associated farms around them, but into the larger power system. Today, their young people may leave the state to acquire higher degrees, but they come back, Mr. Chairman. Imagine if that happened here. That was the seed that was the start of this bill. Mr. Chairman, the four utility CEOs have had massive input into this. REAP, that's Renewable Energy Alaska something P, I don't know, but REAP, ACPERG has input, the IBEW, the piece that Senator Wilson asked a question about recently, that piece was placed there with collaboration from the utilities who hire the maintenance folks and the unions that perform that work. Lots of folks have had input into this. Ms. Riddell is going to go through each section and tell you where it came from. We incorporated several of the governor's bills as well as his executive order related to the Alaska Energy Authority Board, separating it from the ADA Board. As you may recall, that executive order was unconstitutional. To make it constitutional to have an AEA board, we put it in a statute, Mr. Chairman. So if it's with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I will suggest Ms. Riddell take you through a PowerPoint that will explain each section.
Ms. Riddell, please identify yourself for the record and go over the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Riddell, and I'm serving as staff to Senator Giesel. And as she said, I have a PowerPoint to walk through a sectional to give you an idea as to the purpose of the various sections and where they came from. So the first four sections are what I would call improvements to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Section one is designed to clarify and update the qualifications of individuals who are nominated to serve as a commissioner. It requires that any commissioner nominee have at least 5 years of experience in the field associated with their degrees, or they must be a member of the Alaska Bar Association in good standing with at least 5 years experience, or a professional engineer registered under the professional engineering licensing statutes. Section 2 was added by amendment in the Senate Resources Committee. This serves to increase the salary of the RCA chair and commissioners from range 27 to a range 29. Section 3, this came from Senate Bill 224, which was the governor's bill to increase the surcharge paid by regulated entities to pay for the operations of the RCA. And then Section 4 clarifies that the RCA may consider diversity of energy supply, promotion of load growth, or enhanced energy reliability in determining if an electric utilities rate is just and reasonable.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Hoffman.
On Section 2, was that put in there as a request from the RCA board? Did they feel that they were underpaid? And what is the salary increase of the two ranges, from range 27 to 29?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it is my understanding that the sponsor of the amendment felt that this would help with recruitment of qualified individuals since we were increasing and changing the qualifications, that the salary needed to be changed to be commensurate with those qualifications. The difference between a range 27 and a range 29 equates to approximately at entry level $7,800 per year. $7,800 per year.
That was in what was the pay at 27 and what is the pay at 29?
The pay at 27 entry level was approximately $113,000 and it would take you to approximately $120,000.
I'm assuming that they were having trouble recruiting people for the RCA. Is that why they went to this level?
That is my understanding, Senator.
Senator Bishop has a question.
Just to comment on this increase in the on Section 2, We heard this and talked about this in the Energy Security Task Force this summer. So this will go hopefully a long way to hiring more, getting more qualified people, because people were leaving the RCA regulators to go on to higher paying jobs, and that seems to be a common theme across the, a lot of our conversations here at the table.
And that number three, what was the increase from, and what is it? What would be the surcharge at the increased rate?
Do you have that information readily handy, Ms. Rudolph?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'll have to get back to you on the actual dollar amount. In terms of the changes, it went from 0.7 to 0.98, but I know that that's not giving you the actual dollar change, and so I'll need to go back and get that and provide that to the committee.
And that's to go ahead and meet the expenses of the RCA.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Good with the presentation.
Section 5 establishes the net metering program. So this provides for retail customers to receive a monthly credit at the full retail rate. After each 12-month period, any unused credits will expire, so you cannot carry the credits year over year. And then after 7 years, customers enrolled in the program will no longer be allowed to participate. So I just want to clarify for you that this is when you enroll in the program and you put up the equipment, you have 7 years to participate in the credits, and then that expires.
Senator Wilson, you have a question.
Yeah, just trying to, I guess my previous question was, what happens after the 7 years in terms of billing to, for customers that may choose to integrate their power systems to the grid?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, they will go back to paying the regular rates and not receiving any credits for excess power produced for themselves.
And I guess as a follow-up, why the March 31st deadline? Instead of a fiscal year or calendar year?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't have an answer for you. I'll have to go back and find out why March 31st.
Thank you.
Senator Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can only speculate. It gives you all winter to use your credits. That would be my guess. Winter loads have a tendency to be higher than summer loads. The question, though, would be to make sure I understand. After 7 years of being able to sell your surplus electricity you made back to the utility, at that point, the benefit a customer would get from having equipment installed on their side of the meter that generates power would just be the avoided power that they don't have to buy from the utility. They would no longer be able to sell the utility back extra power at any price. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
And just one more follow-up. A prohibition on that, or no longer a requirement that the utility, would it be up to the utility?
Through the chair, it would be up to the utility.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I comment here?
Senator Diesel.
Sure. So the reason for that time-limited period is so that we don't have folks overbuilding, putting on more solar panels than they need actually for their home, so that then they have a massive amount of excess power. The other interesting thing about this section, Mr. Chairman, is we've gone back and forth between net billing and net metering. They're different. Net metering reimburses at a retail rate. Net billing reimburses at a wholesale rate, which is much less. So this has gone back and forth between conversations with the governor's office as well as with the utilities. At this time, it is net metering because there was a piece of legislation passed on the Senate floor maybe last week that was related to net metering, and to avoid confusion, we've kept the net metering piece. But there is a difference between metering and net billing. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
With all due respect, Senator Diesel, don't you think that you're stifling some of the entrepreneurship or some of the forward-thinking people that are willing to go and invest in putting more renewable resources out, more renewable energy resources out there on your house, wherever it happens to be?
Well, you could certainly take that perspective. On the other hand, the utility has to be reimbursing at a retail rate, Mr. Chairman. And if they were entrepreneurs, they could actually create an IPP. They would avoid taxes. And if they're under 15 megawatts, they wouldn't have to apply for RCA approval. So there are multiple other avenues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Oh, I just wanted to I think I made comment to this yesterday, and I apologize if I didn't. You know, in the macro that was touched on, not overbuilding renewables capacity, right? And so hence the 7 years. And that's the question I've been asking all along, and is on your bigger projects, my opinion, there's only so many kilowatts on the rail belt that can be that we can absorb with renewables. And what is that, right? But the university in a presentation put it into perspective for me the other day was California was the fourth lowest electric rates 20 years ago, and today they're the fourth highest. And if you go back and look at the history, it was around this renewable revolution in California.
Got a comment, Mr. Senator?
I do, Mr. Chairman, but I just forgot what it was.
So, has to do with California's rate going from being the fourth lowest to the fourth highest.
I can't remember. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Renewables.
Just
Senator Bishop.
Because notwithstanding the fact that the utility's got a duty to produce, and they still got to have the base load. Because the wind don't blow and the sun don't shine all the time.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Would it make sense to, after the 7 years, move to a net billing?
Senator Diesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Merrick, that would be up to the utilities, or you could make an amendment to the bill. Remember, when we're talking about excess generation, and we'll get to this in the bill, we have the Rail Belt Reliability Council, and in the bill, that organization, created by the Senate Bill 123 in 2020, will have jurisdiction over generational planning, integrated resource planning. That means generation. So when they're approving, when they're looking at our generation supply, they're going to be assessing whether this wind project or this solar project is creating too much power, because their goal is to make sure we have stable, reliable, economic power. So there is an organization in place that will be assessing that generation to make sure that we're not having excess. Thank you.
Bob, Senator Mayor?
No, thank you.
Ms. Rodell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 6 creates transparency in power purchase agreements, and this addresses concerns that have been raised through a number of different channels that the independent power producers will not, as for-profit entities, will not be passing along any tax benefits that they receive. So this amends Alaska Statute 4205.431 to require that power purchase agreements between public utilities or between a public utility and an independent power producer reflect the tax benefits provided to the independent producers or the utilities. Okay. Section 7 streamlines the regulation of independent power. This is the amendment to exempt construction of energy facilities producing 15,000 kilowatts or less from pre-approval by the RCA. To be clear, when this power comes online and is sold, it comes under RCA regulation and the RRC planning pieces of it. But it exempts them from having to go before the RCA to get approval for construction prior to the start of that project.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Rodel or Senator Giesel, the governor's staff deferred a little on the details of this. Can you help us with whether this has limited applicability to this new RTO region, the Railbelt region, or whether it applies statewide? And let's start with that.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this applies statewide.
Follow up, if I may.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. So when we look at different sizes of utilities and different costs of various generation projects, there can be the potential for a really sizable impact on rates from a project of this size. I think this would be, in terms of base load, probably 20% of Juneau's local need. In terms of peak load, you know, maybe it's closer to 15, 12. For Alaska Power and Telegraph, those numbers are much, much larger. Would it be prudent to limit this faceplate exemption from the RCA looking pre-construction, maybe by utility size, by potential scope or scale?
Ms. Rodel.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is certainly an amendment that could be offered in this. I would just note, however, that the discouragement from building something too large is the inability to sell it. So to your example, a developer of energy is not going to build a project so large that the utilities surrounding it can't absorb that power. There's no incentive because there's no way to purchase it. You would just have a spillover. So I'm not sure what that would achieve in your example.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The RCA in its regulation, at least for-profit utilities, looks at a number of categories for the prudence of the project, including the project's finance. And so this pre-approval process actually reduces risk to a utility building a new generation project that they will put a whole lot of cash out or take on a whole lot of debt and then have some element, whether it be cost overruns or whether it be elements of their financing plan and their impacts on rate, be ruled imprudent by the RCA and not be recoverable in their rates, leaving the utility stuck. I think we have significantly different potential impacts within a rail belt system with an integrated resource plan, which I think is great, than we do with islanded for-profit utilities subject to RCA regulation. So I'd like to work with you further on that.
Do you want a response?
No.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. 15,000 kilowatts, is this just in terms of construction of energy facility for temporary sites as well? For sites that may be going up and sort of a rural site that may be buying power from a company that will be selling it to another company to be utilization for camps, mining facilities, or other items across the state?
Mr. Chairman, this was a question that I asked also. Incidentally, this particular section was brought to us by Chugach Electric. It's important that you know we didn't just think of these things ourselves. But it's for examples, the Willow Solar Project is about 17 kilowatts, and I'm told that Fire Island is about a 12 kilowatt project. So the idea here is that these smaller projects actually would be made more economic by not having to go through a very expensive and extensive RCA review. At the same time, the Rail Belt Reliability Council, the ERO, two terms for that same organization, would be looking at these things as well. To Senator Keel, Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Keel, you certainly could amend this section to require it only apply to the Rail Belt area if there was concern here about Southeast.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just kind of curious. I'm not familiar with the, a lot of the extents here relative to our little intertie in Southeast. But one of the advantages of the intertie in Southeast is we could put generation anywhere I want it. And I'm just, and I assume this is going to be the case here also. Once this is all interconnected, we could put generation up and down the line anywhere that it's the most cost effective. So is there an expectation that there'd be a lot of small independent power producers doing 5 megawatts, 10 megawatts of hydro generation and tying into the system? Do we have a potential of attracting a lot of that type of smaller producers?
Mr. Adell.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I have not seen a forecast of supply, but I think the expectation is that given the diversity of the rail belt, that they want to accommodate both large projects and small projects to come in.
Senator Stedman, follow up. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 8 is improvements to the Electric Reliability Organization. So this will repeal the requirement that the ERO must develop an integrated resource plan. I realize I wrote this sentence slightly incorrectly. What this is doing is it's requiring that the ERO participate in an integrated transmission plan. It will still provide an integrated resource plan. So it does not repeal that section. It amends that integrated resource plan to not include transmission planning. So I apologize for the misstatement on this slide. Additionally, the ERO will be required to prioritize reliability and stability of the system served by the ERO and take into account cost to the consumer.
Questions on this slide?
Mr. Chairman, may I add something here?
Yes.
There are so many, Mr. Chairman, there are so many terms sometimes in these documents. So ERO, Electric Reliability Organization, is the same entity as the Rail Belt Reliability Organization, the RRC. So it is an entity. It exists now. It's been in existence for 4 years. So just to help clarify, sometimes these terms get confusing. Thank you.
So you're saying that they are the same thing?
They are the same thing. Our, the state of Alaska's ERO, mm-hmm. Electric Reliability Organization, is titled Rail Belt Reliability Council. And it has been in existence for 4 years. They have a board of 13 members. It is a very diverse board.
Senator Bishop.
And we had a presentation from them yesterday. As you weren't here, you were negotiating on another bill.
Senator Geese.
That is correct. You did hear from them yesterday. I think his name is Joel. I'm forgetting his last name. Very knowledgeable, but he presented to this committee yesterday. That's the ERO that we're referring to here.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 9 conforms the ERO tariff to the revised streamlined ERO duties. So it amends it, and I included the language here on the slide. So it's going to require that the ERO's tariff includes non-discriminatory standards for interconnection, and that is what must be included in their tariff. They will not be including standards for transmission system cost recovery because we're going to provide for that later in this bill.
Okay.
Section 10 adds that a load-serving entity that would otherwise be exempt from regulation shall adhere to the ERO's reliability standards. It requires them to coordinate with the ERO and, if applicable, coordinate with the Rail Belt Transmission Organization to integrate these reliability standards into the operational procedures. So what, in effect, we're doing here is we're ensuring that the ERO and the Rail Belt Transmission Organization work together and that they integrate their operational procedures together. Okay. Moving on, Section 11 is a conforming section to include the definition of rail belt and the definition of rail belt transmission organization. The goal here is to make sure that it's very clear that this is only applying, when we say rail belt, only applying to the geographic area between Kenai and Fairbanks and nowhere else in the state. Section 12 is an additional section from Senate Bill 224. This is increasing the surcharge paid by, in this case, pipeline carriers to fund operations of the RCA. So we're making sure that the surcharge increase flows throughout throughout the section. Section 13 is designed to incentivize diversity of generation. So this provides a tax exemption to state and local ad valorem income and excise taxes to any independent power producer that only sells wholesale power to cooperatives and public utilities. So you have to meet both tests. It means any retail taxes that a cooperative would pay will also be paid by the independent power producer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Can we go back to slide number 10? The question that I have is, Who are the pipeline carriers?
Ms. Rommel.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm going to go back and double check that I'm correct before I offer something. But I believe it would be companies like NSTAR up in the rail belt. Maybe others know better, but I want to confirm that and get back to you on that. And I can get back to you also the dollar amount that I promised you for the utilities for the pipeline carriers as well.
And there is no objection from them to this provision?
Through the chair, we have not heard of any objections.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
We do have, I don't know if she can answer, but we do have a section manager from RCA online that might know off the top of her head for Senator Hoffman's question.
You got to answer that question to the RCA person that's on, Senator. Miss Alvery, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I am Becky Alvey, Advisory Section Manager of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Okay. We have our RCA question for us. Senator Hoffman, would you want him to restate the question?
If he could, please.
Page 10. Who are the pipeline carriers that are going to fund the surcharge? And how much is that? And is there objection from the pipeline carriers?
Ms. Alvery.
Through the chair. Senator Hoffman, the pipeline carriers, this includes Hillcorp, Conoco, the TAPS carriers, if they do intrastate business. And so we're looking at primarily North Slope. And then as far as the RCC, what is proposed here is to increase our statutory cap. The legislature approves the RCA's budget, and that goes into the surcharge, and then this would increase the cap. Currently, as the cap is set, there is potential that the RCA's budget may exceed the current cap, which would not allow the commission to collect through the regulatory cost charge the amount that it would need to fund our operations. And so based on the budget that the legislature would approve would be what the change to the RCC is. I know there's a staff member that is has been asked to try to put together kind of a rough number of what that would look like. I do not know that number right now, but we will certainly get back to the committee. And then we have not heard any opposition to an increase to the statutory cap from either the utilities or from the pipeline carriers. It was one of the items that was recognized in the Energy Security Task Force, the report from that, and to ensure that there was funding for the RCA.
And follow up, has the question been asked whether or not they would object to this?
Ms. Aldrey.
The pipeline carriers.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we have not directly asked that question from the RCA to any of the pipeline carriers. We do, as we go through our regulatory cost charge update every year, we put out what the new surcharge would potentially be in an order for comment, which we have not historically received comments from.
I guess since we're changing this law here, I would ask that you contact them and see what their response is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Alvey, could you get back to us on what the response is to the question?
Yes, Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Rudell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe we are now on slide 12. Slide 12 incorporates Executive Order 128 or Senate Bill 243 to amend and provide for Alaska Energy Authority to have an 8-member independent board. It also allows the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development to delegate to a deputy or a director, and it provides that each public member serve a 3-year term. It also requires the board to elect a chair and a vice chair every 2 years and provides that a quorum of 5 is needed to meet, along with an affirmative vote of 5 to take any action.
Mr. Rodell, on the 8-member board, are all those going to be voting members?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chairman.
How do you avoid a tie?
It fails, so you need an affirmative vote of 5 for anything to pass.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
Section 17 provides that the powers and duties, amends the powers and duties of the Alaska Energy Authority to allow them to provide the services required for the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, and it also allows the AEA to acquire battery and other energy storage systems.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the subject's come up a couple times, but I think at some point we need to have a policy discussion on what we want or what we're comfortable with Alaska Energy Authority owning. And there seems to be an expansion of ownership of the lines. And I think a lot of people recognize those are lost leaders compared to the generation side. And now we're looking at allowing them to own batteries, storage facilities. So I think there's, at some point, we need to have a conversation on that. You know, what should that role be? I don't think they own a lot of these assets in other places. So anyway, I just thought I'd make that comment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Rodell or Senator Giesel, do you have a response to this comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Senator Stedman, the AEA is... the goal is to ensure electric power, and acquiring these energy storage systems actually can assist the utilities. Many of the utilities now have invested in various energy storage systems. There are multiple new ones coming on board. Hot salt, pumped water, but all of these require a significant investment. And if AEA, which is actually a state entity, can assist with that, it assists with the cost of power for Alaskans along the rail belt. So there is a fundamental philosophy to allow them to participate more in some of these costly assets. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that yesterday, if we going off of memory, AEA did show three potential, I want to emphasize, acquisitions on battery storage from the three different utilities.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you for the committee's information. I think this committee is going to be looking at the question that Senator Stedman raised, and that of AEA and ADA, because it seems as though their powers and authorities need to be reviewed, and what are we delegating to them when we have the power to appropriate and in debt. So the indebtedness is a question as well. So just for the committee's information. Thank you.
I totally agree. Senator Stedman.
And just for clarity, we did talk to the AA, and I understand that there's some benefit to having a state organization to secure federal funding, some grants, and so on and so forth. And I don't think there's too much issue with that. Clearly, we want some help in these high-cost infrastructure development build-outs. But at some point, there needs to be discussion. Is that the entity that we want to hold these power lines? Or should it be the utilities or some other consortium outside of the state, some kind of a group? For instance, the extension cord in Southeast is not owned by the state. The communities of Petersburg, Rhineland, and Ketchikan collectively take care of that system. And I think that's not a bad model. They do have landslide issues in the Stikeen River for under submarine cable. They have some of those challenges. Not going to be too dissimilar than going across Cook Inlet. Anytime you go across a water body, things happen over time and lines degrade. So I just think that that policy discussion needs to take place at some point.
Senator Thiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's worth thinking through the diversity of electrical infrastructure. One of the big power cords here in Southeast is owned by the Industrial Development and Export Authority. And the payments to use that are one of the sources of ADA's dividend. We all enjoy appropriating, but it's not a state subsidy to the user, to the electrical consumer. I did have a question on this slide and AEA providing staff and administrative services to the new entity RTO, and it looks like the AEA's fiscal notice to the first version of the bill, so it doesn't speak to this. Will this require, do we think, any additional staff, and will they be paid via receipts from the RTO and the transmission charges, or do we envision that being general fund funded employees? How does that work?
Senator Giesen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel, the next section of the bill goes into depth about the Rail Belt Transmission Organization that is being created. This upcoming section will address the discussion about the ownership of assets and things like that. The Rail Belt Transmission Organization it's not a piece of AEA. AEA is a part of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. Just as AEA and the four utilities make up the Bradley Lake Management Council. And so these entities will be the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. And when we get to this next section, you will see that they have a revenue mechanism incorporated into this. These are the next few sections. You'll also see in one of the sections, at some point, the Rail Belt Transmission Organization may construct, own, and operate new backbone transmission assets, which of course would include battery systems as well as transmission lines. So it might be interesting to go on to the next sections and really dig into what we're talking about with a rail belt transmission organization, who's on it, how their revenue will be generated, how they will pay for costs.
Happy to defer, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Without objection, go ahead and go on to the next section.
Section 18 is the creation of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. This was in the Senate Resources Committee version of the bill. It was amended by the Senate Resources Committee. So I'm going to walk through what it looks like in the bill today before you. The first section establishes the RTO under the Alaska Energy Authority for the purpose of developing this backbone transmission system for the rail belt. When you create an organization in statute, organizationally, you need to have it placed in the org chart, as they say. This is within the AEA, similar to the fact that the AEA provides support and coordination for the Bradley Lake Management Committee. It will provide that same function here for the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. It is required to establish a governance structure that provides for the oversight of the RTO, and it creates a management committee that is composed of members representing each of the utilities, the executive director of the AEA, the chief executive officer of the applicable ERO, an individual from an independent power producer, and an individual from a labor union. This was an amendment that came in Senate Resources to amend this governance structure. It requires the RTO to establish a conflict resolution process, and it facilitates public participation in the operations of the RTO. Similar to Bradley Lake meetings are noticed. They are open to the public. They have public comment period. Our expectation is that the RTO will operate in the same manner. Moving on to the next section.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Could I interrupt and just highlight a couple words in section, it's in section 18, but it's under statute 4483-700, which establishes the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. One of the questions that inevitably arises is, will this RTO, Rail Belt Transmission Organization, take over ownership of transmission lines that utilities own now? And I want to underscore the word managing. It's on line 18 of page 10. It is intended that the RTO will manage but not mandate the transition of assets from utilities to the RTO. The utilities have placed significant financial commitments into those pieces of infrastructure. They are not being required to relinquish that infrastructure to the RTO. The RTO will take over the management and the planning going forward, but each of the utility CEOs will have a seat on that table. The other important thing on line 21 is it talks about the role of the AEA, and it is there for administrative purposes that the transmission organization is in the AEA, the Alaska Energy Authority. These are a couple questions that have come up, detailed questions that have come up as the bill has been worked through various stakeholders. Ms. Rodell highlighted the board membership, the governance structure. Pardon me, it is not a board. It is a governing structure that included on line 10, number 20, line 28, the chief executive officer of the applicable rail belt reliability organization, or the electric rail belt or reliability organization. Mr. Chairman, in the original bill, that was a non-voting member. That's an important piece. It was changed in Resources Committee. In addition, item on line 31, 30 and 31, and the next page, continuing lines 1 through 3, were also added in the Resources Committee. After the fact, Mr. Curtis Thayer, Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority, pointed out that those changes to the board structure are not acceptable. related to the bonding authority of AEA. I believe Ms. Robidel can highlight further, but this is an amendment this board, this committee right here will need to make in this bill. Those three pieces, items C, D, and E, in 4483-700 need to be removed, Mr. Chairman.
And that's to go ahead and protect the bonding authority of AEA.
You are correct.
Okay.
Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Stedman.
Could you give us an idea of roughly how many employees this organization may have, and are they going to be state employees or non-state employees? Or, and then I have another question.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it's designed to work like Bradley Lake Management Committee, which doesn't have any direct employees. They use the employees of the utilities and the employees of AEA.
Bob, Senator Stedman.
And then just another, I guess, food for thought. If these utilities decide that they like each other and they want to work together and actually merge, because some utilities south are fairly large, some of these grids, multi-state actually, and they may inevitably want to reduce their, I guess, their or merge so they can get some more synergy and get their rates down. Are we facilitating or restricting that in this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we are not restricting that.
Okay.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding Section 18 on page 11, line 26, how much time did the Resources Committee address the word may versus shall on line 26.
Senator Deason.
Mr. Chairman, the word may has always been there because we are not mandating that they construct, own, and operate, or that they take possession of any of these assets. This is what their function will typically be, but we're leaving it permissive. I also would comment, the characterization was that perhaps these utilities would get to like each other and work together. Just a reminder, the Bradley Lake Management Council has actually been working, functioning for more than 40 years. This is the four utilities and the CEO of the Alaska Energy Authority. So for more than 40 years, they've had a conflict resolution process in place, and they have worked together. But that term may on line 26, to my recollection, has always been part of this bill.
Bob, Senator Poppin?
Well, I think that's the debate that Senator Stedman brought up. With this legislation, there's a sea change in that the entities are going to be tax exempt, which is a huge, huge issue that Senator Keel had mentioned. So I think that the committee should look at that issue and talk to the members of the utilities regarding at least owning and operating the transmission lines. The construction may be a different issue, but I think there's merit that this committee should look at that question that Senator Stedman raised, not only at this committee, but at previous meetings.
Yeah, response, Senator? Mr. Riddell?
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Hoffman raises a very important point about how we are trying to, through this legislation, create to deal with a number of complex pieces of what is constraining the rail belt grid today. And it's creating the coordination of planning. It's creating the coordination of those transmission assets. And then it's creating the open access tariff which I'll get to on the next slide, a couple of slides, that allows then those independent power producers that will gain the tax exemption to enter into power purchase agreements that are going to be RCA reviewed and regulated, that will then go into a new transmission system and allow that generation, those molecules, go to wherever the demand is, whether the demand is in Homer, whether the demand is in Healy, or anywhere in between. And so I think understanding how all of these pieces fit together and relate to each other are very important.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Well, just to rather than repeat what Senator Hoffman said, just a little additive that we asked the other day, the Alaska Energy Authority, to review the grant data on GRIP funding that we're going to be working on next winter to see when they can divest themselves of that asset, the power lines. So they're supposed to get back to us so we can consider how we want to have the inevitable, the final layout and or the final build out and payoff, how we want the ownership to look like.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stedman, because this gets me to 4483710, which is on the bottom of page slide 14, which sets out the powers and duties of the RTO. And the one I want to point to that we haven't talked about, because we've talked about the ability to purchase, that they may purchase, lease, or acquire, but it provides that no assets may be sold, exchanged, donated, or otherwise conveyed without the express approval of the legislature. So because these assets will be Alaska Energy Authority-owned assets while they're being funded and constructed, we want to make it very clear that it will not be up to the AEA to decide how to dispose of the assets at this time.
Bob, Senator Stim?
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking of through the construction of it. I was thinking after it's constructed and the bonds are paid off, you know, how we handle that. Because some of us are not very comfortable with AA expanding their ownership and think that there's other entities that should be owning these assets and they should be facilitating construction and development, not permanent ownership of some of these assets.
Senator Giesen.
Mr. Chairman, the section that we're talking about here is the transmission organization, a rail belt transmission organization, not AEA. AEA is certainly part of it, but the four utilities are also part of it. I will also add the section that Ms. Rodell just highlighted, that none of these assets can be sold without, and on top of page 12, approval of the legislature. Came at the request again of stakeholders who said Berkshire Hathaway was here in the state a few years ago. Rumor had it that they were attempting to purchase transmission assets. So they requested, stakeholders requested, that it be clearly stated that those assets could not be sold without approval of the legislature as the appropriating body. So there was a serious reason that that section was added. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't have any problem with that. The question that Senator Stedman is bringing up, and it's related to the powers and duties of the transmission organization. It says they may own them and they may operate them. The question that Senator Stedman is saying, at some time, should it be required in this legislation that they shall own and that they shall operate under a specific time frame and not be the responsibility of a state entity? That's the question. That's the policy question.
Senator Diesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, great question, and maybe you want to amend it to set a time limit, but this was the May is there, again, because utilities themselves have put significant money into purchasing or building these assets. They have bonds to fund these, and at this time, they are not willing to relinquish the ownership to the RTO. They will continue to own these assets. The RTO will simply manage the transmission of the electrons. But if you wanted to put a limit, a time limit, certainly that is the purview of this committee.
Senator Bishop.
I'll yield to Senator Stedman.
Just for clarity, I recognize that there's outside interests sometimes that come into our state and want to purchase our cash cows and leave us with, you know, the cost centers. So I'm not interested in that. What I'm talking about is either the utilities or the communities or several of the utilities go together and all. I'm not talking about a third party from Texas coming up here and mucking around in our business. As an example, several years ago, there was an entity that wanted to purchase the municipal utility in Sitka and their hydros. My response is, when hell freezes over, would you cut loose those hydros? It's very beneficial to the citizens to own their own utility. They have it privatized, and Senator Hoffman's brought it up numerous times, the effect that he saw in Bethel. And we have our communities in Southeast, and Juneau is a little bit different with ALNP, but all of the communities own their utility and the power lines for the most part in Southeast.
Senator Giesel, you have a response?
No, it's great information. I believe there is a situation in King Cove where they built a hydroelectric project that now is a problem concerning their rates, and I know that this committee will probably address that as well. Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last of the capitalists, I guess, in my district. Senator Giesel, the questioning has focused kind of on 710B, which is about may construct, own and operate new backbone transmission. But when I look at subsections of A there under the shalls, manage backbone transmission assets, purchase, lease, or otherwise acquire, it doesn't say backbone transmission assets. It says acquire effective operational control of them. Can you help me understand what the difference is between managing them and having effective operational control of them, and how much of them you have to own to do those two things?
Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel, I believe the answer to that question could most credibly be given to you by one of the CEOs of a utility. I don't know who's online that might be available. We also have Gwen Holdman, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, here in the room, who might be able to answer that. So I would defer.
Senator Keel, you want to hear from Ms. Holdman?
Mr. Chairman, if Ms. Holdman is comfortable, that's great. Otherwise, we can take it from someone else later on.
Ms. Holdman, would you mind coming on up and giving us your perspective on the answer to the question? Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Senator Keel, through the chair, would you mind repeating your question for me?
Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best to be a little more succinct this time. So looking at page 11, we get to the powers and duties of this new organization. Shall manage the backbone transmission assets, shall purchase, lease, or otherwise acquire effective operational control of the backbone assets. So it's kind of a two-parter. What's the difference between managing them and having effective operational control of them? And how much of them do you have to do those two things? Do you have to own them?
Ms. Holman.
Senator Keel, through the chair. This has actually been probably one of the pieces, as has been alluded to, that the utilities have spent the most time discussing, including all the way back to this policy tour in Iceland. The idea here is that there is not a need to necessarily transfer ownership of those assets because a lot of them are tied up in bonding authority with those individual utilities themselves. So to sever those particular assets from their all of their debt would not be in the best interest of stakeholders in terms of cost. And so the idea here is that a utility could have the option of selling their assets into this RTO. They can maintain them, but the idea is that there is operational control, management control of the asset as a whole, which is something that's not happening right now at this time. We're not looking out for the interests of the system as a whole, which is why you see things like with this SSQ line, with the Swan Lake fire, why there was a need for the state to step in to fix an issue there. And I do want to also just comment really quickly that there have been numerous failed attempts for the utilities to work together to form an entity outside of the state that would perform these functions or even more functions associated with a unified system operator, even a generation and transmission holding company. ArcTech is an example of that. There's a number of other examples. You mentioned, this idea of potentially selling it to a for-profit transmission corporation. None of these have succeeded. They have all failed because at one utility or another has disagreed with that particular approach. And that is really why there is some need for legislative action. A lot of the ways that this system is designed and the process by which it is being formed is very much analogous to what was learned from Iceland, because that is probably the most analogous system to Alaska. They started out with a rail belt a transmission organization that was outside of the state as kind of standalone quasi for-profit owned by the different municipal utilities plus the state. They learned over time that it was far more efficient and more cost effective for their individual ratepayers to actually take this model that we're doing now. And so when we asked them about their lessons learned, this was the approach. They said, start here, don't start with a different approach. And they were actually able to pretty much immediately save about 10% as a result of forming this kind of an organization to their consumers, in addition to making it much easier to sell and purchase power among the different users.
No further questions?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It's valuable history, and it's an important overall goal. I'm still going to need some follow-up on what our management and control, the way the bill uses the terms. And Senator Geisel talked about changes in a board effectively changing control and that being an action of default to the bondholders. So if we're talking about changing control, are we setting a time bomb under this when the bondholder says, oh, no, you don't. You can't give operational control to the RTO. I'm your bondholder and you have an obligation to me. It sounds like the same thing.
Ms. Holden.
Yeah, Senator Keel, this is, through the chair, this is exactly why it's really important that this management committee is made up of the asset owners. That's a really important component of this as it relates to bond covenants.
I'm sorry, Senator Wilson, you had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, in talks of in generalities, do we know what the cost to the ratepayers and consumers would be upon passage and implementation of Senate Bill 217?
Ms. Holden.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, what we're doing here with this organization is really getting our house in order, okay? The purpose of this is really to organize our assets, get our house in order. It also doesn't commit us to a future approach. We could certainly move these assets out of state ownership in the future, but it organizes our assets and the management of these assets, both the ones owned by the state and the ones that aren't owned by the state, for the benefit of the whole. This legislation and this approach is likely not in and of itself going to result in immediate reduced costs to consumers, but it organizes our shop in a way that sets us up to get the cheapest cost power to consumers wherever they're located. So it's more of like a structural institutional change that allows us to get cheaper power to consumers.
Oh, I guess just as a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Sure. I guess my question is overall, and maybe it's for the state, maybe it's for Senator Giesel's office or somebody that's working this piece of legislation, just wondering what is the direct impact to the ratepayer over the short-term and long-term goals? And so I'm just trying to see what impact our constituents will have in terms of this consolidation, whether they be a co-op or independent or another issue, just what's that impact going to be to the ratepayer? You don't have to answer. I'm just anyone out there, they can provide that information to the committee.
Senator Bishop has a question.
I'd just like to add a comment to that, to Gwen's comments. I think this bill is really looking prospectively into the future. All this renewable stuff that we're talking about, that's just pie in the sky if you don't have a transmission system to distribute it. You can't wheel it north. You can't wheel it south. And I just put that out there. And I'll leave with this. It's like when we did Bradley Lake and it passed by one vote because it was so expensive, higher than gas, and today it's 4 cents off the dam face and the cheapest power we got. And I keep asking myself, why didn't we build Susitna at the same time?
So far, we are past our time to find on a journey. We can either go ahead and have you finish up, Ms. Rodell, or we can come back at 1:30.
Do you
have a preference?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a preference. I'm at the will of the committee.
What's that? Senator Giesel, you have a comment?
I just wanted to add one last thing, Mr. Chairman, to conclude this slide and section 4483710. On line 7 and 8, it states the work must be performed subject to terms and conditions of any existing collective bargaining agreements. It relates to work performed on new construction or maintenance. Mr. Chairman, this came at the request of unions who are right now engaged in CBAs, collective bargaining agreements, with utilities. They did not want to be cast aside and had someone come in and make other arrangements. And so we agreed and put this piece, belt and suspenders, in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and recess until 1:30 this afternoon.